So I'm walking up some scaffolding, and I guess it's scaffolding like you'd find on any building site around where you live, but this scaffolding is out in the middle of native bushland. I'm surrounded by native eucalypts. I could reach out and touch the bark on them. We're in the middle of a forest, and this scaffolding's just part of the Ukeface experiment. And today we're going to be talking to some of the people behind this experiment. I'm Joel Werner, and you're listening to Off Track on ABCRN.
Ukeface stands for Eucalyptus Free Air CO2 Enrichment. And the point of this experiment is to work out how natural Australian bushland responds to elevated levels of carbon dioxide, specifically the levels of atmospheric CO2 we can expect in the future.
We're at 22 metres height. These platforms are mostly for scientific instruments that get mounted up here, and the cranes are more for getting us into the treetops. Some of the people in Western Sydney thought we were building a shopping mall here, so we had to reassure them we were not.
Cranes, scaffolding, and scientific instruments, all in a natural bushland setting. The people of Western Sydney could be forgiven for thinking that something strange is going on in their local forest. That's Professor David Ellsworth from the Hawkesbury Institute for the Environment at the University of Western Sydney. The Ukeface experiment is his baby.
We're in a bit of native bush in Western Sydney that is a grassy eucalyptus woodland. So there's eucalypts and grasses, and there are a fair few native species out here. As far as we know, this site's been wooded for at least 80 years. It could be longer, in fact. And it's a native bush site, and the objective was to be able to expose that native bush site to an elevated CO2 concentration that we expect in 35 years. Only 4 years ago, I would have said more like 50, but emissions have ramped up, particularly in the last 2 years. We're exposing that native bush then to a CO2 concentration that's about 40% greater than it is now. It's risen about 15% since 1980, and we will ramp that CO2 concentration up. We'll gradually increase it, but at a much faster rate than it's currently increasing, about tenfold faster than that current increase. And then we'll hold the woodland constant at that higher CO2 concentration for between 5 to 10 years to really study the responses. What's unique about this and is different from any other face experiment in the world is it's built into this native bushland. So we have native species here, and we have them pretty much arrayed as they would have been, and we're exposing them to that high CO2 concentration, and we expect some of the dynamics of these species to change, some of their distributions, some winners and some losers under high elevated CO2. And those are all questions that remain unresolved that we want to try to answer in this experiment.
We'll head back to the forest to find out exactly how the Ukeface experiment works later in the show. You're listening to The Best of Off Track on RN Summer. And this week, it's a special feature on the science of a changing climate. Last year, Dr. Joelle Gerges and her colleagues at Melbourne University reported an alarming finding. Over the past 1,000 years in Australia, the 5 decades since 1950 have been the warmest. But what else do climate scientists know? In 2013, where's the science at when it comes to understanding climate change?
Well, in many ways, it's where it was at in 1990.
Professor Andy Pittman is the director of the Australian Research Council's Centre of Excellence for Climate Systems Science.
We know that the planet's warming. We know it's warming due to the emissions of greenhouse gases by human activity, primarily. We know that warming has been accelerating on a global scale. We know that the heat content of the oceans is increasing, as you would expect, that many other things like the flora and fauna are changing as we'd anticipate as a consequence of warming. We understand the basic mechanisms behind those things. And there hasn't been a single piece of science that's withstood scrutiny for decades that casts any significant doubt on any of the basic science.
And so what does this mean for, say, Australia in the coming 30, 40, 50 years?
The thing we can be confident about is that there will be warming in the averages, that if you warm the averages, you significantly increase the likelihood of extreme temperatures. Heatwave conditions, for example, particularly hot days, things like the 48 degrees that was experienced in Melbourne that most of us thought was implausible. But what most people are really interested in is what's going to happen down to the scales that they live, what's going to happen to my community living in Perth or Adelaide or Sydney. And that is at the cutting edge of the science. It's where the science is at the moment in trying to understand the detail of how a global warming signal and a warming over Australia will perturb things like the rainfall patterns.
Earlier this year, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC's SREX report, did exactly that. It looked at what the cutting-edge science has to say about the impact of climate change on extreme weather events in the future. Neville Nichols, an Australian Research Council professorial fellow at Monash University, was the lead author on the SREX report.
The report was initiated because there's concern amongst many people that the climate and weather events are becoming more extreme, or extremes are becoming more frequent. There's also this underlying science that we know the world is warming. It's warmed about 0.75 degrees in the last 50 or 60 years. We know to a very strong level of confidence that that's because of the increased carbon dioxide in the atmosphere that burning a fossil fuel is causing. So that's the underlying things. The concern about whether extremes are getting worse and whether that's due to our known actions in causing warming of the global average temperature over the last 50 or 60 years. So as a result, the scientists who are involved in the Intergovernmental Panel of Climate Change Report and people from the disaster risk reduction community came together to write this report to look at the evidence of whether climate and weather extremes are changing, how they're changing, and what the disaster risk reduction communities can do to actually manage the risks of disasters and catastrophes in the future.
And so what did you find?
What we're most confident about is that hot days will increase in frequency and magnitude, cold days will decrease in frequency and magnitude, and the same applies to nights. So very confident also that heat waves will continue to exacerbate. At the next level of confidence, we're pretty confident that heavy rainfall days will also increase in frequency. We're pretty confident that coastal extreme sea level heights will actually increase also. We're less confident about projections of droughts and floods, and there are some things which we just can't say anything about. That's really the small scale phenomena such as tornadoes and thunderstorms. Our observations of those aren't complete, our physical understanding isn't sufficient for us to make projections, and the models don't simulate them at all. So we say we've got low confidence. Now, people sometimes want to take that as saying, we're saying there'll be no change. We are not saying that. We actually say there will be change. It's just that we have low confidence in even predicting the direction of change. Will they get worse or better? But that doesn't mean to say that there isn't a risk that these things will get worse. It's just we can't predict that with confidence at the moment.
So the confidence that climate scientists have about what's going to happen in the future varies from prediction to prediction. Some things they're really confident about, other things they just can't tell yet. But how do they know what they know? Have you ever stopped and thought about what climate scientists actually do? Like, how does Professor Andy Pittman build a climate model?
Well, first of all, you collaborate with as many groups around the world as you can. So climate science is an international science now. So the ARC Centre that I lead has collaborators in the UK, in France, in North America, and we're already beginning to link with New Zealand and China. So it's an international science. A global climate model now is almost beyond the capacity of any one country to build independently. But what you do is you go and get all the data you can. Some of that might be very old data, paleoclimatic data from many millions of years ago or from before the last ice age or up to the present day. You collate all the observations you can of anything and detail process understanding of people who run experiments of how changes in climate or changes in carbon dioxide affects exactly how a plant functions, for instance, or how the stomates in a leaf respond to elevated CO2, many, many other areas. And you describe those observations mathematically. Now, you take those mathematical descriptions. Some of those are gravity or exactly how a fluid moves around a sphere, the laws of motion that Newton discovered, the conservation of mass that says, in mass terms, if I precipitate rainfall onto a landscape, you need to know exactly where that water goes. It can't just disappear. It has to be evaporated or sucked into the soil or taken up by plants. And that's called conservation of mass. And there's also conservation of energy. You can't create or destroy energy. It has to be used. And so we take all of those basic physical laws and we take all of the data and we program them into software that runs on some very, very big supercomputers. And we take initial data that describes the state of the system commonly back 100 or 200 years. And we integrate that mathematical model on the supercomputer into the future. And we do that many, many, many times. And we refine the model over a period of many, many years until we are confident it's capturing the processes that are important. And then we move that model forward in time and look at how that affects climate. But that's an ongoing and an iterative process that continues in many groups around the world. And, of course, in each step of that, we're looking to falsify the model. We're looking to find ways where the model is inconsistent with observational data from satellites or ships or aeroplanes or surface thermometers. And the more we fail to falsify the model, the more we build confidence in its ability to say something important about the future. When you do a climate projection into the future, what we now do is we change aspects of the model. We change the initial conditions, we change the rate of CO2 increase, and you do many, many runs to get what's called a probabilistic estimate of how things will change in the future. So we don't say it will change by X. We run it many, many times to look at the probabilities of a particular phenomena in the future. And it's that that tells us that if you double CO2, there is no probability of the planet warming by less than about 1.4. And it's a very low probability of it warming by less than 2 degrees. And it's a very low probability of it warming by more than about 5 degrees or 6 degrees. And that gives us that range of roughly 2 to 5 degrees for warming in the future. And most of that 2 to 5 degrees is linked to decisions by humans on the rate of change of greenhouse gases in the future. That 2 to 5 degrees is not the scientists don't understand the climate, it's that we have to incorporate into our future change a range of possibilities in terms of CO2. So if you want 2 degrees of warming, we have to undergo dramatic reductions in greenhouse gases. If we carry on as we've been going, then we get 6 degrees of warming. So the 2 to 5 or 2 to 6 degrees is about how we respond as a species more than issues around the understanding of the physical climate system.
I think there's two important points there. One is that to look into the future and to try to model the future, you really base it on observations of the past. And I think that's skimmed over too often, that it's building the mathematics of what's happened before now that allows you to try to predict what's going to happen in the future. And second, that it's scenario-based, that there's not just one future that you can predict, but there's many dependent on what we do now.
The nature of science is to try to falsify what you've done. We try to find problems with what we do. We spend our time trying to prove that doubling CO2 doesn't lead to warming. Because if we were able to prove that, we'd win a Nobel Prize and we'd be really kind of pleased about that. So we try to prove ourselves wrong. And it's after 10 or 20 years of exposing the climate models on a literally daily basis to observations and being unable to find serious problems with the models, despite every attempt that we might undertake, that leads us to think that the models are giving us valuable information about the future.
The IPCC works at a level above this. It aggregates the findings of climate scientists world over to come up with confidence estimates for particular events. And then it publishes reports on its findings. Neville Nichols.
The work we do on this is sort of, it's time-consuming and complicated. The way the IPCC works, for instance, is the IPCC doesn't do research. It's an assessment body, and it assesses the scientific literature published in peer-reviewed journals and books. In my chapter alone, or a chapter of which I'm a coordinating lead author in this special report on extremes, we've got about 1,100 references. So what we do is we assess other people's research. And some of that is our research. We're all active researchers in the field as well. But throughout this process, we've applied a very rigorous method for actually trying to assess the uncertainty of our conclusions. And we get a big range in the uncertainty. So some things we're very confident about, other projections we have medium confidence about, and some we have just low confidence. We just can't predict which way they'll change. And we are very confident that we're right about carbon dioxide causing global warming because of theoretical understanding of the physics of the Earth and work that's been going on for over 150 years now.
Indeed, one of the most confident findings of the climate science community is that unless we do something drastic and do it soon, levels of atmospheric carbon dioxide will continue to increase in the future. Up next, we head back to the bush to find out how the Ukeface experiment will measure the impact of this increased CO2 on native Australian bushland. This is the science of a changing climate, on the best of Off Track. I'm Joel Werner and you're tuned in to RN Summer. It might come as a surprise to find that the scientists at the Ukeface experiment are pumping out CO2-enriched air into the Hawkesbury forest ecosystem. They're doing this to simulate the atmospheric conditions that native Australian bushland might face in the future. But how do they do it? David Ellsworth.
We've constructed a vertical array of pipes out here in the bush, as you see around us. None of the structure actually sits on the ground, and that's unique to the construction here because we felt that by doing this in native bush in Australia, we had to maintain the integrity of the lizards and snakes and other organisms that move across the surface of the ground. So everything is sitting up off the ground. There was no real digging to construct the experiment either, so we've tried to maintain the integrity of this native bushland essentially by building the structures. The structures are 500 kilogram vertical pipes made out of a glass fiber composite, and they're in a unique structure that's all tied together as you see up at the top, and that structure can actually sway in the wind like the trees do here. And hopefully that means when it's windy everything is moving in concert rather than bumping into one another.
As you approach the Ukeface experiment, you start to worry that you might be lost. You're driving down a single-lane road, surrounded on either side by native forest. Then suddenly, in the distance, poking out above the canopy top, it appears. A series of eggshell-white pipes, all connected together and arranged in a series of six cylinders, each cylinder with its own crane towering above. This structure is the atmospheric time machine, elevating levels of carbon dioxide in the forest to what scientists expect they'll be in about 35 years' time. Senior Engineering Officer Steve Wall is in charge of these massive structures.
The structure is essentially 32 vertical vent pipes. Each vertical vent pipe has a series of holes in it. Those holes are where the CO2 comes out and blows through the ring. We modulate which pipes are open depending on the weather. So we follow the wind speed and direction, and as the wind moves, we go to the upwind portion of the ring and open up those vertical vent pipes. That vertical vent pipe has CO2 that travels up it. The CO2 is mixed with air, so it's a pre-diluted system. the fan puts out 2,000 liters per second into a large, about 400 mil wide pipe, and that pipe is connected to all the vertical vent posts.
Are you constantly measuring the concentration of CO2 to feed back into the system?
Yeah, we have a control point at about 23 meters. It's towards the top of the canopy, and that's where we're shooting all the gas to, is the central point. We monitor at 32 different points throughout the entire canopy and all the way down to the forest floor to make sure that we're getting even spatial distribution of CO2.
If a big wind comes from the west and starts blowing through, then does that mean that you pump more CO2 into the rings to maintain the concentration that you want it to be in there?
Yeah, the valve located before the CO2 is mixed into the fan will actually open up wider and allow more CO2 to be mixed into the constant airflow, and that's how we'll achieve the concentration at the center of the ring.
It's a massive structure, and it's impressive in just how large it is. How long did it take you to set this up?
We're still building it a little bit today. But each array, just the vertical vent pipes that you're looking at, is it's a 9-story tall structure, so it took about 2 weeks to put up a single ring. We have 6 rings, and then that doesn't include running all the services and mains power, installing all the plumbing works and 32 actuators with 32 lines going back to a PLC. We've been working on it now for about a year straight, and we've probably got another couple of months to go.
When I visited Ukeface in May 2012, there'd been a year's worth of construction and calibration. But the experiment proper didn't start till September 1st, when the CO2 was switched on. So what are the scientists going to look for now that the study's underway? David Ellsworth.
We'll look for the changes in photosynthesis, changes in water use by the vegetation. We'll also look for changes in the growth of the trees. We'll look for the changes in the overall productivity of the ecosystem, because this is designed as an ecosystem experiment, an ecosystem being a set of species that work together, that live in a certain place and interact with the environment. So we're now altering that environment. We expect that set of species to potentially change, and so we want to monitor it. We expect also the dynamics of those species could change over time as well, and they could change with prevailing weather patterns. So that means that we need to actually study this system over a number of years, because we may get some results in a particular year that was anomalously wet or dry, and we'd want to see what's really the test of time for the outcomes that we're monitoring.
You are following this experiment over a decade, but I mean, with the ramping up of concentration levels of the carbon dioxide, when do you start to notice changes? At what point do you start to see a change in the ecosystem?
We don't know. That's one thing we really need to understand, because there's a lot of talk about tipping points in climate, but we don't really understand what the thresholds are for carbon dioxide. And it may be that certain ecosystems are actually currently saturated at the current level of CO2, and increasing CO2 won't provide any further change in those systems. No one's actually done an experiment like this in the Southern Hemisphere. No one's done an experiment in native bush that comprises tall trees at all. So that's really, really novel. And then the other aspect is that we're doing the experiment in our nutrient-impoverished landscape in Australia with our very, very ancient soils. And those are really have been missed by the global science community in terms of the science that's been done. It's been done in North America and in Northern Europe.
Professor David Ellsworth and Steve Wall at the Ukeface experiment. You also heard Professors Neville Nichols and Andy Pittman. If you'd like to hear Andy and I discuss emergent behaviours of climate models, including how, under certain scenarios, the Sahara might return to a fertile landscape in the future, head to the Off Track website. Just go to abc.net.au/radionational and search for Off Track. Once you're there, you can download audio, follow links to further information, or check out our image galleries, including pictures of the towering Ukeface experiment. Or come say hi on Twitter. I'm at Joel Werner. That's all there is for this week. Until next time, bye for now.